From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, discrimination and the ban on gays and lesbians in the military, we talk with civil rights attorney Hai Feldblum. She says the ban is a civil rights issue. Feldblum is policy director of the new group Campaign for Military Service, organized to rally support to lift the ban. Also, we meet Japanese-American actor, playwright, and poet Lane Nishikawa. His one-man show about the cultural absurdities of being Japanese-American is called I'm on a Mission from Buddha. And book critic John Leonard remarks on the fourth anniversary of the death sentence that set Salman Rushdie into hiding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali threatened today to withdraw peacekeepers from Croatia unless Croats and ethnic Serbs stop their fighting. The United Nations has around 14,000 peacekeepers in Croatia, where at least 18 peacekeepers have been killed. In a report to the Security Council, Boutros-Ghali said there's been no progress in ceasefire negotiations and no sign of any let-up in the fighting. The UN chief said that unless matters change, he will not recommend that the peacekeeping mandate be renewed. Western governments have criticized a decision by the Bosnian authorities to stop distributing emergency food to their own people in Sarajevo until relief convoys get through to parts of eastern Bosnia isolated by the fighting. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Sarajevo City Council has, in effect, imposed a hunger strike on its constituents. According to reports from the city today, most food distribution centers were indeed closed. A spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said, while UNHCR understands the concern for people in eastern enclaves, quote, we don't feel that this kind of grandstanding is very productive. It's not a sensible response, said Lord Owen, the European Community's envoy in Bosnia. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. deplores the blocking of food aid by any party in Bosnia.
And we would call once more on all the parties to the conflict to honor the solemn commitments that they made during the London conference concerning the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid.
Boucher said the airlift to Sarajevo's airport will continue for now, even if food is not being delivered in the city. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
German authorities are dealing with questions today about how an Ethiopian man was able to smuggle a gun on board a Lufthansa plane at Frankfurt Airport and hijack the plane to New York. Deirdre Berger reports.
The 20-year-old hijacker came to Germany last August seeking political asylum, according to Frankfurt police. He lived in a refugee shelter north of Frankfurt. Earlier this month, the man voluntarily withdrew his asylum application, and German authorities gave him a return ticket to Ethiopia. German officials say the man evidently hijacked a Lufthansa plane on his flight back to Addis Ababa in the hopes of obtaining political asylum in the U.S. At a press conference in Frankfurt, police rejected criticism that the hijacking was possible because of lax security at Frankfurt Airport. But the government says it has launched a major investigation into airport security practices to determine how the hijacker could smuggle a gun onto the plane. For National Public Radio, this is Dietra Berger in Frankfurt.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 3,392.43. Declines led advances by a margin of almost 2-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 216 million shares. This is NPR News. The former chairman of the Silverado Savings and Loan has been acquitted of all charges that he illegally took loan money from the thrift for his personal use. After deliberating for about 4 hours, the federal jury acquitted Michael Wise of taking almost $500,000 of a business loan and using it as his own money. It was the first trial stemming from Silverado's 1988 failure, which cost taxpayers an estimated $1 billion. A new congressional report disputes the widely held view that excessive regulation of the nation's banks has reduced lending. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The report issued by the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, focused on bank lending during the 1990-92 period. It says lending practices are determined by the relative strength or weakness of a particular bank rather than onerous government regulation. Both strong and weak banks reduced the amount of outstanding commercial and industrial loans held during the two-year period, but the CBO report says the decline is due to economic conditions and not excessive regulations. Strong banks increased lending by an annual average rate of approximately 3.1% between 1990 and 1992, while weak banks cut back 3.6% a year. House Banking Committee Chairman Henry Gonzalez said the CBO report puts one more chink in the armor of those arguing that banks are not lending due to excessive government regulations. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
There were reports from Capitol Hill today that President Clinton is planning to cut spending on NASA's proposed space station by about 40%. Supporters of the project, like Congressman George Brown, say a cut like that would force the space station to be scaled back and redesigned. Brown is a Democrat with major aerospace interests in his California district. Opponents of the space station say the proposed cut is not enough and that the $30 billion project should be killed outright. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Gays and lesbians do not have the same civil rights protection as heterosexuals. If they face discrimination in housing or on the job based on sexual orientation, they have no recourse under current federal laws. So says Hai Feldblum, a civil rights attorney and activist who's trying to change that. She's a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center and director of policy for the newly formed Campaign for Military Service, which is working to lift the ban on gays in the armed forces. She's also helping to draft a new civil rights bill for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Currently, a patchwork of state and local laws exist. Some state and local legislatures have enacted laws which protect the rights of homosexuals. Some, like Colorado, have banned laws to protect those rights. I asked Feldblum why a federal law is needed.
I would love if the world was such that we did not need a federal law to protect the civil rights of anybody. The problem is that discrimination exists. Discrimination existed against African Americans, so we needed to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Discrimination existed against people with disabilities, so Congress needed to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act. In this day and age, there was widespread discrimination against gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals. And there needs to be a federal law that says that discrimination is illegal in order for these individuals to have protection.
Let me tell you about an argument I heard recently, and this was on the radio. I heard someone say that there was a distinction between the discrimination against homosexuals and the discrimination against African Americans. And what he said was that homosexuals had never been denied a seat at the front of the bus or denied the right to vote or forced to use separate bathroom facilities the way the blacks have. The implication of the argument was that somehow the discrimination was less total and therefore less insidious and therefore needing of less protection.
I heard that person talk on the radio, and I mentioned it to my class, which I teach at Georgetown, and I teach a class in sexual orientation and the law, and I asked my students what they thought about that. And it was interesting because both the gay and the straight students felt that the argument was completely misplaced, as I do. The reason black people were sent to the back of the bus was because people knew that they were black. You couldn't hide that. The reason gay men and lesbians and bisexuals have been able to get on the bus and get into restaurants and walk around the streets is that nobody knows necessarily that they're gay or lesbian or bisexual unless they say so or unless they seem to clearly fit the stereotype of being a gay man or a lesbian. If someone overtly fits those stereotypes, then those people often cannot walk down the streets without fear of danger, without fear of someone actually harming them. And if the person does come out and say, I am a gay man, I am a lesbian or a bisexual, then in fact they do experience the same extent of discrimination, potentially in employment and housing and restaurants and bars.
Let me ask you about a case that the Supreme Court ruled on in the mid-'80s. It was a case from Georgia, Bowers versus Hardwick.
Yes.
Tell us about that case, and then tell us why this is such an important case in the gay and lesbian community.
Bowers versus Hardwick was a challenge to the sodomy law of Georgia. That sodomy law prohibited oral sex between people of the same sex as well as between people of the opposite sex. Homosexuals and heterosexuals were both covered under this sodomy law. The Supreme Court, however, decided to view the law as just applying to homosexuals, and it said that the state of Georgia had the right to make homosexual sodomy illegal, and that gay people did not have a constitutional right of privacy to their sexual activity.
And what are the implications, then, of that ruling?
The implications are enormous and incredibly devastating. Although most gay men and lesbians are not prosecuted under sodomy laws, so there is not an immediate implication of someone coming into a person's house and prosecuting them under the law, the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled that the sexual activity of gay people can be criminalized has been used as the basis in numerous other cases dealing with employment, dealing with housing, dealing with family matters, to rule against gay people on the reasoning that gay people are essentially criminals in half of the states in this country.
Why do you think the Supreme Court ruled the way it did?
You know, it's interesting. I clerked for Justice Blackmun right after that case came down. So I came to the Supreme Court literally a week after Bowers was handed down. And it was a very interesting experience for me to walk around that courthouse a week after they had ruled that I was illegal in half of the states of this country. So I thought about that question. Mm. Why did they rule this way? And I think they ruled that way because there was not a true understanding of who gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals are. As I'm sure you know, Justice Powell announced publicly that he changed his vote in that case. So this case could have come out the other way, 5-4, if Justice Powell had gone with the side written by Justice Blackmun that the right of privacy, if it means anything, means the right to control one's own sexual activities. But I think that the justices were affected by the social constructions that this society has created about homosexuality. And those constructions are that homosexuality is sinful, it's bad, it's immoral. And that if you allowed homosexuality to be protected, where would you then draw the line? I think if the justices of the Supreme Court, as well as the people of the country, begin to accept, as I believe they are, that homosexuality is simply gay people and lesbians loving each other in a way that is not immoral and not bad, I think Bowers versus Hardwick will come out the other way.
My guest is Hai Feldblum, and she's the director of policy for the Campaign for Military Service, working to ensure that the ban on gays serving in the military is lifted. She's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. How would a federal gay rights bill be worded?
Well, it would track the different areas in which discrimination exists. And it would cover employment and housing, businesses that are open to the public, the federal and state governments. And it would basically literally track the language of existing civil rights laws so that gay men and lesbians are not getting special rights, but are getting rights that are equal to the rights that are currently set forth in laws that protect people on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, and disability.
So you would look to the 1964 Civil Rights Act?
Correct. Our models in writing this law will be the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 1968, which covers housing, and the Americans with Disabilities Act that was just passed in 1990.
What is the procedure, then, for introducing a bill like this, and how do you shepherd it through Congress?
Well, actually, a number of us have been working over the past weeks, a number of civil rights groups, to to help draft a bill that the that members of Congress will introduce. A member of Congress in the House and a senator, you know, or senators in the Senate, will then introduce the bill. There will be hearings on the bill, and then the bill will go forward just as any other bill does, for a vote in the relevant committees and then on the House and Senate floors. I think all of us expect that this will be a process, a development of both the law and a development of support for the bill, so that ultimately there will be a majority of votes for the bill in both the House and the Senate.
Are you using the word process as another word of saying it will be a hard sell?
I'm using process to mean that I don't think the bill could be introduced next Monday and passed the following Monday. I think it's going to take some time. I'm not sure I would call it a hard sell. 5 years ago, I would have told you that I think it would take 20 years to get this bill passed. Now, I believe this bill could get passed within the next 4 years. I believe that the American public has changed in very significant ways in realizing that discrimination is simply unfair and has no place in this country.
You know, I'm really surprised to hear you say that, only because there was such an uproar about the issue of gays in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to talk radio at all, you can certainly get a feel for, at least the more vocal parts of the public are very much against this idea.
Uh-huh. I think that's true. And I think there are two things that we take from the response to gays in the military. One is that that issue will have to be resolved before the gay civil rights bill, you know, moves forward in any significant way. And I expect over the next 6 months, and part of what the coalition, the campaign, will be working on, is trying to reach out to the American public and change the points of view. I think there is a very large, non-vocal majority of this country that believes that, as Barry Goldwater, I believe it was Barry Goldwater, said, the issue is whether you can shoot straight, not whether you are straight. And I think that a lot of people, basically in their gut, believe that that's the case. So, number one, I think that ultimately the ban on the military will be lifted, that the public will ultimately be in favor of that. And then, in an ironic way, I think that that will help us with the gay civil rights bill, because if you listen to the senators and members of Congress on the floor, they keep talking about how the military is different from the rest of society. It's so different. And, you know, the showers and the this and the that. And as one of my friends said, listening to Senator Thurman, he addressed Senator Thurman on the TV screen and said, you know, Senator Thurman, a lot of jobs we're talking about don't have any showers. So you see, the thing is, once people realize that having gays in the military is actually not going to be a devastating thing, will not affect morale and discipline, and people will be able to get along, then, of course, there shouldn't be a problem letting gay men and lesbians be open in the workplace and be open in a restaurant and be open in their housing.
We have to take a very short break, but first let me reintroduce my guest today on Fresh Air. She's Hai Feldblum, and she's a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. She's also the director of policy for the Campaign for Military Service, working to ensure the ban on gays in the military is lifted. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hai Feldblum, and she's a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. If homosexuals are given equal protection under the law and are accorded civil rights as everyone else has, Will we see then same-sex marriages being legalized, or will we see companies having to give health insurance to same-sex domestic partners? Will we see child custody laws, adoption laws being changed?
Well, you've touched on all the issues that I expect members of Congress to ask us when we bring forward the gay civil rights bill. I think it's best to think of it maybe as a staged process. A gay civil rights law would not necessarily mandate same-sex marriages because Congress can write the law any way that it wants. It could mandate same-sex marriages. But I think what we're more likely to see is basic protections in employment and housing and access to goods and services being passed. As part of that, I do think that there will be a fight about insurance benefits, because I think the gay community will appropriately argue that just as spouses get benefits such as health benefits and bereavement, etc., we deserve the same benefits for our partners. So I think that will be asked for in a civil rights bill. I don't know if Congress will decide to pass that. I think the last thing that will happen, when it happens, and it's, I think, a long way down the line, is same-sex marriage. I think that a lot of other forms of discrimination will be eradicated from this society. I think that we will have domestic partnership laws set up that will give us the equivalent of marriage without the name. And then the last thing, the element that will really show that the social construction of being gay has changed from something immoral and sinful to something that is simply another way of loving somebody, will be when states are comfortable in according marriage licenses.
You're involved in this new group, the Campaign for Military Service. What are you doing, in terms of a procedure and direction, how are you going to argue this issue or educate the public or educate members of Congress on this issue of gay and lesbian civil rights?
Well, the basic premise on which the military bases its exclusion of gay men and lesbians, bisexuals from the military is that other people in the military could not handle being around openly gay people. That is the basic underlying premise for the ban. That is exactly the premise that was used to say that black people cannot serve with white people in the army because white people would simply be too uncomfortable. And I think the answer to that in the military as well as anywhere else has to be that you cannot cater and condone and approve other people's prejudices. You have to work to change them. And sometimes, just as with African Americans, the only way to change that prejudice is to simply say, as a federal policy, we will not condone discrimination. These people can serve openly, and now let's work together to get used to it.
When talking about the issue of privacy in the military, it seems that the fear, as I understand it, and let's just take men are taking a shower together. There are straight men and gay men in the shower together. If a gay man is attracted to a straight man and the feeling is not mutual, is there a privacy violation going on in that shower because of the one-way attraction?
I think that question is based on a premise that sort of doesn't really exist in reality. I can't begin to tell you the number of gay people who have said to me since this has come up, why do these straight people keep thinking we're so attracted to them? You know, we're not. We're attracted, usually, to other gay men. In fact, Barney Frank said to Dan Coats, I've been taking showers with you for years in the gym. It hasn't been a problem. This is in the congressional gym. I think the idea that gay men or lesbian women, if you're taking a shower together, that the gay person will, A, necessarily be attracted to the straight person, and B, even if the person was at some point in their back of their mind, that they would do anything that is untoward or inappropriate is simply not the case. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience, I would not at all approach a straight woman because I would just be afraid to approach a straight woman if she's clearly not interested. So I think that the premise is simply not true in terms of how things operate. I also think it's interesting to note, and again, this has been mentioned to me by others, that men are finally realizing what sexual harassment might feel like to women. And their fear that there might be someone who will harass them and they can't protect themselves is overwhelming. Now, in reality, as I just said to you, I don't think there will be any harassment the way there is harassment from men to women. But even the concept that they might be the objects of unwanted attention scares these men like crazy.
Before this issue of gays in the military became such a feisty political one, within the gay and lesbian community, was that considered the number one issue, the issue that, you felt had, the greatest implications for other rights?
Well, 3 years ago when I was at the ACLU as their lobbyist on gay rights issues as well as AIDS and disability, we were focusing at that point on gays in the military for the reason that it was the one remaining institutionalized form of discrimination in this country. That is, it was a major federal institution that mandated discrimination. I mean, employers, private employers and private landlords had the right to discriminate, but there was no mandate of discrimination. And here was an institution that had a mandate of discrimination against gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals. So this is not a new issue for the gay community. 3 years ago when I was working on this issue, working on the general issue of gay rights, gays in the military was definitely on the top of our list as something that simply had to be changed. We also felt that that was simply one small portion of society, and what we really needed to achieve ultimately was freedom and civil rights and protection for gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals in all sectors of society.
You certainly get the feeling that many in this country believe that, homosexuality is a sin, that many homosexuals choose their sexual orientation. And as a lawyer, how do you argue this when, I mean, when you're talking about religious feelings, emotional feelings, psychological feelings?
I think that's difficult. I think that people have the right to their feelings and emotions about anything, and no one has the right to tell anyone else what to think in their own minds. I think the law has the obligation to stop people from acting on those feelings when it will hurt other people. If someone wants to believe that the fact that I'm bisexual is a sin and bad and immoral, that is their right. But I believe that my country has the right to protect me, and my country, I'm sorry, has the obligation to protect me from that person acting out on those feelings and hurting me. I think the fact that so many people have had, I think the fact that there's a history of homosexuality being sinful and immoral and bad is what we have to counter with education and information and actual experiences of gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals, because otherwise we really never will change things in this society.
Heifel Bloom, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Heifel Bloom is a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center and director of policy for the Campaign for Military Service, working to lift the ban on gays in the armed forces. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with actor, playwright, and poet Lane Nishikawa about acting, Japanese Westerns, and the irony of being Japanese-American in Japan. Nishikawa wrote and performed the one-man play I'm on a Mission from Buddha and is appearing in the upcoming Mike Myers film, So I Married an Ex-Murderer. And 4 years ago, writer Salman Rushdie was sent into hiding because of a death sentence that the Ayatollah put on him. Book critic John Leonard reflects on the anniversary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has announced plans for a new immunization program that he says will eventually guarantee vaccinations for every child in America. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
The plan announced by the president has been sitting on the shelf in the Department of Health and Human Services for more than 3 years. It calls for $300 million additional dollars to build up the country's public health infrastructure so that public clinics can keep longer hours, educate the public about the dangers of not vaccinating children, and provide vaccines at an affordable price. In announcing the plan, the president was highly critical of drug companies that charge exorbitant rates for children's vaccines. He directed the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate with drug manufacturers to get them to offer discounts to states that are interested in developing low-cost immunization programs. 10 states already have such arrangements, and while these efforts get underway, drug manufacturers have pledged to cooperate with the administration and Congress in devising a plan to immunize all preschoolers. In Washington, I'm Brenda Wilson.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says that he will have to pull UN peacekeepers out of Croatia unless factional fighting is stopped there. In a UN Security Council report, the Secretary General said that there has been continued fighting in the area and no progress in diplomatic efforts to get a peace agreement. There are now some 14,000 UN peacekeepers in Croatia, and at least 18 have been killed. UN peacekeepers are stationed in 4 Serbian-held areas of Croatia, where local forces have refused to give up their arms, fearing Croatian attacks. It appears that another battle is brewing over funding for NASA's $30 billion space station. A member of Congress who favors the project said today that the Clinton administration plans to slow the project by cutting its budget 40% next year. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Even though NASA has already spent $8 billion on the space station, every year there's a big fight in Congress about whether to continue the massive project, and if so, how quickly to dole out the money. The space station is headed for yet another battle, according to Congressman George Brown, a Democrat with major aerospace interests in his California district. Brown says the Clinton administration plans to cut way back on space station funding, so the cost of this huge project can be spread out over more years. But Brown and other space station supporters argue that the project can't survive in its current form with such a big budget cut. This dispute should be settled later this year when Congress and the White House compromise on the federal budget. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 30 points to close at 3,392.43 on volume of more than 216 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Officials in Germany say that they will investigate how a hijacking suspect was able to smuggle a pistol on board a jetliner yesterday at Frankfurt's International Airport. Prosecutors say that they may ask the U.S. to extradite the suspect so that he can stand trial in Germany. Identified as a 20-year-old Ethiopian, he has been arraigned in New York City on a charge of air piracy. Yesterday, the hijacked plane, with more than 100 people on board, landed safely at New York's Kennedy Airport. The former military ruler of the West African nation of Mali and three senior military officers were sentenced today for their role in trying to quell pro-democracy demonstrations. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
A Malian judicial panel sentenced former President Moussa Traoré and three former high-ranking government officials to death after finding them guilty of mass murder. After a trial that lasted nearly 10 weeks, Traoré was convicted of ordering security forces to fire on crowds of pro-democracy demonstrators nearly 2 years ago in Mali's capital of Bamako and other cities. At least 106 people were killed by soldiers during the protests before junior officers overthrew Traoré's 23-year military regime in March 1991. The former president was arrested while attempting to flee the country. Defense lawyers for Traoré, the former head of the army, and the defense and interior ministers said they would appeal the sentences. Last year, the transitional military government that toppled Traoré organized the first multi-party elections in 30 years, paving the way for democratic rule. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
American Airlines says it has filed an unfair competition complaint against Iberian Airlines and Air France, charging the two air carriers with blocking American from selling its reservation system in France and Spain. The U.S. air carrier also named the governments of Spain and France. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Lane Nishikawa is an actor, but his career hasn't really taken off in Hollywood.
But, you know, you go out there for the auditions and the casting calls, and, the only roles for Asian actors in television and film are two-line, two-bit character parts that don't even think. They're waiters that do laundry, you know, or cooks that never learn to ride a horse. Kind of like all the odd jobs I did to keep myself in this business so I could get up on stage once in a while and play a real-life feeling, thinking human being.
That's from Lane Nishikawa's one-man show, I'm on a Mission from Buddha. He developed it at San Francisco's Asian American Theater Company, where he was the artistic director for 3 years. He's been an actor, writer, and director with the company for more than a decade. The show has been touring around the country for the past 3 years and was adapted for public TV. Nishikawa has also managed to get some roles in film. He appeared in Wayne Wang's Eat a Bowl of Tea, Stephen Okazaki's Living on Tokyo Time, and Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World. In his own play, I'm on a Mission from Buddha, Nishikawa deals with the issues of identity and discrimination, and he talks of his family and how his parents would send him off to school in goofy clothes with a buzz haircut that made it impossible for him to fit in with the other kids.
But my old man did redeem himself, though. That's because he took us to samurai movies when we were young. Yep, every Saturday night, we catch the latest samurai flick at the Toho, and those guys were bad. Nakadai. Kinosuke. Hashizo. That blind dude, Zatoichi. And the John Wayne of our people, Toshiro Mifune, and Mifune was bad. I mean, he would duel it out, right? With 50 bad guys. By himself. At night, in 2 feet of snow, there'd be an arrow stuck in his left thigh. You know, he'd be carrying a small child. His castle burnt down. His father beheaded. His mother seppuku. Oh, God, you know, it started raining. 70 mile an hour winds. And then the bad guys would cheat. They'd take out guns. No, cannons! He'd lose an eye. His sword would break. But he'd win. Mifune was amazing.
Did American action movies seem tame compared to the samurai movies?
Well, I'll tell you, if you compare some of them, like Seven Samurai, mm-hmm. which is probably one of my favorite mm-hmm. films, and then they made The Magnificent Seven.
Right.
It did lose something in the translation, I think. Sanjuro and Yojimbo. Were both came out in the early 50s, and then they came out with Fistful of Dollars, the Clint Eastwood, the gun with no name. Well, Mifune was a sword with no name. And there was something in this figure that I felt never happened with Clint Eastwood. It was a combination of an incredible amount of honor underneath the portrayal of this hired killer. Even underneath it, there was, he came from a samurai class, and things like that in the movie were so strong that whereas in Fistful of Dollars, I didn't feel that as much.
Now, when did you want to be in the theater? When did you begin to take theater seriously?
I think I started out basically as a writer in the early 70s out of San Francisco State University. I had a lot of great instructors that showed me a whole different direction with writing called free verse. And with it, we used to go around the different universities, community events, and basically it was a freestyle poetry, storytelling kind of combined. And then I heard of the Asian American Theater Company, and they asked me to audition, and I did. From the first Asian American play I saw, I knew I wanted to be involved with the theater company.
What was it about that first play?
Seeing an Asian American on stage, watching these people go through what I live, feeling their pain and their search for identity and their place in this country. And I thought that, and it was all done in 2 hours in a story that took you from a beginning to an end and gave you some answers but left you with a lot of questions.
My guest on Fresh Air today is playwright and performer Lane Nishikawa, and he's currently traveling the country with his one-man show called I'm on a Mission from Buddha. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Lane Nishikawa, and he's a playwright and a performer. You're a third-generation Japanese-American, mm-hmm. and from watching I'm on a Mission from Buddha, you talk about being more comfortable in the Japanese section of an American city than in Japan itself. What was it like for you to go to Japan and visit there?
Well, Japan, two things were happening. I mean, it was so amazing just to be there and actually feel like everyone else. It's the first time I've ever felt that.
Did you, because you look like everybody else? Because
Everybody looked like me.
Yeah, right.
There wasn't that initial hit of, oh, here comes a Japanese guy. It was just, you know, here comes a guy, which was great.
Although you said you couldn't read a thing when you were in Japan, though.
One of the funniest experiences was visiting my relatives in Hiroshima. And we're at a big family banquet. And they had to attach an interpreter to me, one of my cousins, because my Japanese was so bad that, you know, they didn't want me to, you know, of course, lose face, you know. So they had this interpreter that sat with my sister and I that explained everything. And when I asked the question, it was spoken. So my dad gets up, of course, after a lot of sake and beer, and he says, hey, the relatives want you to do some of your show for them. And I go, are you kidding me? And they go, no, come on, you're an actor, get up and act. And I go, what are you talking about? They're not going to understand a thing I say. He goes, you got a translator? So I say, okay. So I get up and I do this piece from Life in the Fast Lane.
Did they get it?
Well, what I did was I do, 20 seconds, and I'd look at the interpreter, and the interpreter would translate for me. And then they'd look at her. Then they'd look at me, and I'd do another 20 seconds. And then they'd look at her. And they did. They did get it. But it was the most bizarre performance I'd ever done. And, you know, you're talking about my family that... goes back probably 16, 17 generations that I never even knew about that were alive. We thought they all died during the bombing in Hiroshima. So it was two things were happening. You know, I'm there at the first time visiting my great-grandfather's land, and then I'm trying to perform for him. I couldn't believe it.
Well, did they talk about the bombing of Hiroshima?
Oh, yeah.
How were they able to survive?
Well, see, that's the story, is that when the bomb hit, Hiroshima is in a valley where there's a mountain range all around the city. And the bomb destroyed everything within that mountain range. My relatives lived on the other side of the mountain. So the radiation didn't go over the mountain. It stayed contained within the mountain, the valley. And my father didn't find out for 40 years that he had relatives alive. So we finally go visit, and of course, when I'm going there, my mother tells me, one of your uncles has a scar on his face. Don't stare at it. I go, okay, I won't stare at it. So we go there, and you can't help but stare at this guy's face. I mean, half of his face is just scarred, and you wonder, you know, exactly what it is that happened.
Do you know what happened
at the dinner? He says to me, "You want to know about my scar?" And my mom goes, "Oh no, I can't believe that you. I told you not to stare at him." And I said, "I wasn't staring at him. And you know, I just glanced over there." So he tells me that the story is that he was driving into town to Hiroshima early in the morning, over the mountain range, and just as you know, he got over the mountain, he saw the flash, and he turned his truck. By the time it took him to just turn his wheels, the impact hit his truck, destroyed one side of it, smashed in his window, and burned his face. But he was able to turn the truck around.
Wow.
It didn't blow out the tires, and he was able to get back over the mountain.
Is your family bitter at all at America now? I mean, when you go back there to visit?
Oh, no.
Really?
I think that what they are... The first thing you do when you go there, you visit, of course, the family, and you visit the house, and they have what they call Ohaka, the family grave, where all the, you know, Nishikawas are buried. They keep it in a family plot. People with a lot of land usually have a family plot. Then the next thing they do is they take you to the Hiroshima Memorial, because they want anybody who comes there, especially Americans, to see this memorial, not to spread any kind of message of hate. It's to spread a message that this was a really terrible thing, that it shouldn't happen again, that it's really a message of peace. I think Hiroshima does a lot internationally to spread that message. I think Japan, in my feeling, has accepted the loss that they had during the war, and they just moved on with their lives and rebuilt themselves. And you can really see that wherever you go in the country.
America's amazed that anyone could survive the bomb. That 7 out of the 10 largest banks in the world are now based in Tokyo. That anyone could crawl out of the rubble. That multiculturalism means everything they're not. That anyone could survive the Holocaust. That the camps don't mean summertime. That anyone could rebuild themselves stronger. That the dollar is a yen. It's amazing, amazingly simple. Simple methodology goes back for centuries. Nowadays, Cressidas and Maximas are filling garages in American suburbs. Jim McMahon and Grace Jones are selling Hondas. Toyotas are being manufactured in resurrected Georgetown, Kentucky. Oh, what a feeling. Mitsubishi has cut a new deal with Chrysler in Bloomington, Illinois. Yeah, they've come a long way since the aerodynamic World War II, Japanese Zero.
Well, you were in Wayne Wang's Eat a Bowl of Tea, and you've been in Living on Tokyo Time, Wim Wenders Until the End of the World. What kinds of roles were you playing there?
Cooks? No, I'm kidding. It's really
it
ironic.
So.
I tell this big joke about Steve Okazaki about how I can't stand going to L.A. because you just audition for either cooks or waiters or you know, you do somebody's laundry or this or that. And then he cast me in his movie, and he cast me as a cook.
Ooh.
I actually played a guy who ran a diner, and it was a nice little role, and it was more worthy. The main character of the picture came in and had his coffee and donuts, and basically, instead of having a drink, he had, you know, another donut whenever he felt down and depressed. So it was a fun little role.
So it was a cook with substance.
Yeah, it was a nice little moment, couple moments in the film. Actually, I've played paramedics, like in Whoopi Goldberg's Burglars. In Wim Wenders, I played a drug dealer. The last thing I shot that was called So I Married an Axe Murderer, which stars Mike Myers, and it was shot here in San Francisco, and I actually played a Japanese poet, which was kind of nice. It was the first time I was asked to play myself.
You read some of your poetry?
Yeah, I just used my own work, and it was nice just to be able to play myself as opposed to having five meaningless lines, you know.
So what does a poet have to do with So I Married an Axe Murderer?
Oh, he's trying to be a poet.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike Myers is in that whole San Francisco that beat scene that used to be alive in these old poets, and he's trying to become a writer, and he's roaming around with this older poet from the 60s.
Do you get a lot of movie offers, or you're just very, very choosy? Or
well, I'll tell you, I go in and audition a lot, even if the roles are not that large. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of them that came out, and actually, I found out a lot of things about myself as I've been auditioning. And a gentleman named Jerry Thorpe explained it to me very clearly one audition about 7 years ago. I was auditioning for this movie called Blood in the Orchid. It was about four Hawaiians who were on trial for beating a naval officer's wife back in the 30s. And the role I auditioned for was for a Japanese lawyer who defended them. He really wanted me to get the role. Jerry Thorpe was the developer and director of Kung Fu. So he had a lot of experience, and he had what I liked about him. He had a great sensitivity to the Asian American experience, or to an Asian experience. I went in and auditioned him first, and he said, Lane, one, your voice is too low. Two, you have a very, he says, I hate to say it, a very macho quality. You're just too male when you walk in the door. Producers just don't want that.
Well, I'm shocked to hear that.
Then you need to raise your voice. Get yourself a pair of glasses. Cut your hair. Wear a geeky suit and come in. And I'll give you another shot at the role. And I did all of that. And I went in. And I didn't get cast. But that's okay. When I left, he said, I'll tell you this, though. Every stage actor would love to have your voice. I wish you the best of luck.
Well, great. Lane Nishikawa, thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Lane Nishikawa's show, I'm on a Mission from Buddha, is still touring around the country. This is a rap song from the show about J-Town, Japantown, in San Francisco.
Now, me, Homachi, got sushi to go. Sushi in boat, fresh Magudo. We got shoji screens from a Kurosawa dream. Get old Buddha head, start a bowling team. We got Soka hardware, that's everything you need. From paper lanterns to bonsai trees. Kabuki hot springs, get a quick massage. Underground, lat week, all the garage. Go ahead and park, you got a Japanese car. Get your validation at a hostess bar. Got so many kinds of people like you and me. So many kinds of delicious nigiri. We got the best music. Over at Kanzaki's, the place to get down is in Nihonmachi.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the news today. Robert, what stories will you be covering on All Things Considered?
Well, more developments in and about the former Yugoslavia. We'll be hearing from Trevor Rowe at the United Nations about the Vance-Owen Initiative, where it might go from here, given Secretary of State Christopher's statement of policy this week. Also, a talk with reporter Kurt Schork, who is in Sarajevo, the Bosnian capital, about developments there since the statement of policy by Secretary Christopher. Among those, the City Council of Sarajevo has said, we won't accept any more emergency food until the UN guarantees it can get it out to some of the isolated villages in East Bosnia. And David Mulpas reports on the campaign to support the anti-gay referendum in Colorado.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sunday, it will be 4 years since the Ayatollah Khomeini issued a death sentence on novelist Salman Rushdie. He considered Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses, blasphemous. Rushdie's been living in hiding ever since. Even though Khomeini is dead, Iran says the fatwa, the death sentence, is a religious decree and cannot be revoked. Critic John Leonard has these thoughts.
Salman Rushdie, the blasphemer, wanders the world with a price on his head, or circles it like a communication satellite, beaming down the occasional message to an op-ed page or an awards banquet. The leaders of the great religions certainly aren't listening. From the Archbishop of New York to the Archbishop of Canterbury to the Chief Rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the British Commonwealth, Rushdie is disdained. Nor, with the single exception last month of Mary Robinson, President of Ireland, have the leaders of the great democracies rallied to his cause. Bush wouldn't even talk to him last spring. Spokes-troll Marlon Fitzwater told reporters, Rushdie's doing book tours and things that authors do. There's no reason to have any special interest in him. As for our precious media, Well, they may wear the First Amendment like a bumper sticker or a prophylactic to every invasion of privacy in the lurid culture, but their behavior here has been shabby. As if free speech were a good idea for such toads in the erotic garden as Andrew Dice Clay or Larry Flint, for Pat Buchanan and Louis Farrakhan and any other pip who squeaks. But let's not go overboard for a left-wing Anglo-Indian troublemaker. Look what happened to his Japanese and Italian translators. So, as if a man's life weren't at stake, Newsweek makes fun of a feud between The New Yorker and Esquire over Philip Weiss's nasty Esquire article telling us that Salman Rushdie is not a nice man. He's really a crybaby. And the reason more people don't say so is because saying so is politically incorrect. It says something about journalism in our country that magazines posture in front of experience instead of engaging it, that they look, in their careerist skepticism, for an angle, a spin, or a take, instead of consulting a moral compass, that they strike attitudes, like matches, in order to admire their own wise guy profiles. According to these wise guys, Salman Rushdie isn't Socrates, or Galileo, or Jan Hus, or Thomas More, not even Spinoza, so don't sweat it. Rushdie has his advocates, from the officers of American Pen writing to the New York Review of Books on February 11th, to authors like Nadine Gordimer, Gunter Grass, Mario Vargas Llosa, Margaret Atwood, Norman Mailer, and Tom Stoppard, who declare their support in a new book called The Rushdie Letters, published here next month by University of Nebraska Press. But maybe we should remind ourselves what's at stake between Rushdie and the assassins. He is himself a child of imperialism, a mongrel self, he says, history's bastard. If the British hadn't colonized India, he'd never have been one of midnight's children, partitioned at least three different ways. He'd never have gone to British schools, nor written in English his Monty Python send-up of religion and myth and post-colonial identity crisis and modernist pastiche. The Satanic Verses is about metamorphosis gone wrong, about our having left home once too often for history or the movies, for fiction or advertising, and lost ourselves in a world without love or roots. Stateless, we spin. No more avatars of Vishnu. No more rising out of ashes like a phoenix, nor resurrecting like a Christ. We are reborn as mutants, devolved into parody and farce. For Salman Rushdie, with a contract out on him, there is no home. He is lost, spiraling in cyberspace, the ultimate hostage to sectarian fevers, communal violence, and bloody geopolitics. This Flying Dutchman astronaut ought to symbolize, for all of us, the dispossessed everywhere, the damned and ghostly 20th century homeless, boat people. If he isn't on our conscience, we don't have one.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air senior producer today was Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis and Thad Kirk, who's leaving radio for something called television. Good luck, Thad. We'll miss you. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Gettysburg Address, 272 words that changed the history of American political thought. Writer Gary Wills has analyzed Lincoln's speech in his latest book. He says the president's intent was not only to commemorate the dead at Gettysburg, but to also clear the infected atmosphere of American history itself. Join us for the next Fresh Air.